accession number 27344, reel 19.
Robert Candlelass, reel 19. When an aircraft had a mishap on the deck, would it be important to clear as much debris away as possible, even down to relatively small items? Would that affect other aircraft landing on?
Absolutely essential that everything was swept off, and you would have the flight deck party would man brooms and sweep the deck in that area to get rid of all the debris, because otherwise, small bits of debris could be blown by the propeller blast of the next aircraft on, and that could really do damage to people further aft in the ship. I mean, for example, the batsman or whoever is acting in that capacity at the after end of the ship would be directly in the blast. And again, even if it wasn't something that was going to be blown by slipstream, it might be something that would puncture the next tyre. And you just don't need minor incidents like that, because it's all adding time to the preparation for the next sortie. So it would be swept up, absolutely.
While you were doing your tours and crew, you've mentioned the 9 days on and then back into port.
Yes.
How long was the tour that the aircraft carrier did off the Korean coast and in Japan?
I think we were intended to be there 6 months, but it was longer because of the Ocean's accident in the Mediterranean, and they were coming to relieve us, and it took them an extra 2 months to work up the crew to a sufficiently good standard to come out to Korea. Because you can't send, well, they did during the Battle of Britain, but you can't send people without experience and without the necessary training into an operational situation. It's just not on. So I suppose we were out in Korea for 9 months.
And how did you feel when the tour was coming to an end?
Oh, well, it was a matter then of going home, and we were always excited about that. But it was going to take, 3 weeks or something like that to get home. So the exuberance was curtailed somewhat. But, of course, getting back into Portsmouth was absolutely fantastic, because the families would come down to meet the ship. And I suppose the total air crew in the ship would have been 1,200. So with maybe one or two or three of the families coming down, it would be quite a big crowd to meet them. And as soon as the gangways were down, they were on board. It was great. That was exciting. But then, of course, the Fleet Air Arm used to fly their aircraft ashore to their home bases. And the Sea Fury home base, if I remember rightly, was Leon Solent at that time. And the Fireflies were going somewhere else, I think perhaps to Culdrose, but I'm not sure. But we all had a sort of base that was used quite regularly, and particularly for those coming off these ships, because they were coming off the ships while the ships were in the channel, and it was just a convenient place to go, leave the aircraft and go off on leave.
Had you enjoyed that? Because it's quite a long period of operational flying.
Oh, yes. Well, it was what we enjoyed doing. I mean, that's why we were in the service, was to do that, and we were flying 2 and 3 times a day. And when you're flying, it's exhilarating, exciting, and while the adrenaline's pumping, you really are enjoying it. And although there was a number of sad occasions when people were lost or killed or whatever, got over them very quickly, because it was just one of the things that happened in those circumstances. We didn't have any of this excessive grief that one has nowadays, where you've got to have 520 bouquets against a tree, which absolutely, I think, is ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. And I mean, when you think of the bouquets at Kensington Palace after Princess Diana died, I thought that was mawkish in the extreme. I really did. But, yeah, we enjoyed the the exhilaration of doing it and doing it well.
Could a pilot become addicted to that kind of excitement and adrenaline, do you feel?
For a spell, but not for too long, I wouldn't think. I think it would probably get to the point where, like in the Battle of Britain, some of the younger pilots used to get twitch quite quickly. Twitch is a physical thing that happens as well as a mental thing. And you can first of all see it with a tick in one eye, just pulling the lid. And then you can tell the way they deal with things, whether they are mentally overstimulated or whatever it is. And you really had to watch quite carefully, particularly the younger members who hadn't done it before, that they weren't going to get overexcited. But there was one lieutenant while we were in Korea in the Firefly Squadron. He came back after one operation and landed on, and the first thing he did was to go and see his CEO. He said, "I can't go back again. I can't do that." And he was then taken off to see the Commander Air, the senior aviation officer, and the captain. And he was flown off the ship the next day and flown ashore to an American base south of the front line. From there, back to Japan, and from Japan, flown home. And he then stopped flying altogether and became an air traffic control officer. And sadly for him, an awful lot of people blamed him. You know, they called it lack of moral fibre. And I think that's very sad, because I have come across three officers altogether who have suddenly found that they can't carry on flying. One, for example, I relieved him when we were when I went to RAF Valley as a naval training officer. My predecessor had been flying from RAF Valley in Anglesey to Brodie in South Wales, which is about a 30-minute flight. And on the way, he got so frightened that when he landed, he never got into another aircraft again.
So it could just come on people like that?
Absolutely instantaneous. And I know another officer, the same sort of thing happened, but he wasn't actually airborne at the time. But he just decided, no, sorry, I can't do that.
In the case of the lieutenant while you were in Korea, in many respects, could it be seen as it was quite a brave act to admit that he couldn't do that and not endanger other people?
I would think it was very brave, really. Because he knew, he must have known, that there would be a lot of people who would be a bit scathing about his actions. And I know there were. And in fact, there was one captain I spoke to later that knew us both. And he was particularly scathing in his comments. And I was most surprised, because my reaction was sympathy. But I don't know if I could have done it. But it does happen. It did happen.
One of the things that comes to mind that I just thought of there is, in a daily operation, you've explained a little bit about how you would be briefed for an operation. The debriefing process, what would that have entailed?
Well, it was a matter of coming back in and talking to the briefing officers, and they would ask you questions about the targets you actually attacked, what you saw, and after the attack, what damage did you see? Or what was the result of the attack? And was there anything else in the vicinity that he ought to know about? And if you didn't manage to attack the right target, which target did you attack? And what was the result of that attack? For example, if you had got over the target area and discovered that the bridge you'd been briefed to bomb was already down, hadn't been repaired or something like that. So you always had a secondary target that you would go to and see if you could do some damage there. But it was always, there was a lot of choice about what you could do once you'd attacked your primary target, you were looking for targets of opportunity, and you were just flying around the area at a convenient height being above the range of small arms fire, but low enough to see what was going on. You're at that height, 3 or 4 thousand feet, you could see people on the ground. And by watching, you could get some idea of perhaps what they were up to, if there were farmers tilling a field or if they were people walking in one direction in a fairly determined manner, this sort of thing. So that once you had attacked the main target, you would report the results of it as far as you could see and what targets of opportunity you had seen and attacked, and if the attacks on those were successful. If they hadn't been successful, were they worth making a prime target of? This sort of thing. And it was just, he was asking questions to gain the maximum amount of information he could about what was going on with our prime targets and with enemy action generally in the area.
Where would that information be fed into?
Oh, well, it was kept in our operations room. And then at the end of our particular 9 days, it would be passed from the operations officer of our ship to the operations officer of the ship taking over from us, and they would just go on from there. If the targets of opportunity had proved to be useful prime targets, that could be their first selection of prime targets before they started getting their own. But it was very much within our own very small group, one ship.
It wouldn't be passed into a further network of information?
Not really. It wasn't of any interest to the army ashore. All they knew was that we were doing our level best to stop ammunition and supplies reaching the enemy in the front line. And if we were being successful, there'd be fewer bullets and bombs thrown at them. If we weren't successful, they wouldn't know anyway. So the targets that we were interested in wouldn't interest them, and they wouldn't interest the Air Force because they were mainly defending the army against whatever air opposition was there, and it certainly wouldn't interest the Air Force high level because they just didn't look at the ground at all. They were looking around for enemy aircraft in the air. So it was our pigeon and our pigeon only, and when we'd finished and passing on to someone else, the operations officer would pass his report and targets that might be available for them.
And how well did you get to know your operational area while you were flying?
Oh, very well. Very well indeed. It wasn't all that big. I suppose it would be 20 miles deep from north to south, maybe a wee bit more, and maybe 70 miles from east to west, maybe up to 100, depending how far you were going in doing combat air patrol over the front line. But it would be from the front line about 30 miles north, say, 25, 30 miles north, and halfway along the front line towards the east coast, however far that was. But you did get to know it quite well, but again, not well enough to do low flying at night. It occurs to me that when we were talking about the flying training, I never mentioned the Link Trainer. Now, the Link Trainer was, without any doubt, the first simulator for flying. And it was simply a box which had stubby wings and a stubby tail put on it to give some representation of an aircraft so that you would know which way to get in and which was facing forward. But it was simply an elementary cockpit with the flying controls and the flying instruments. And it was simply a matter of teaching you to scan these six instruments and keep the thing flying in the direction that you wanted it to go. It had similar instruments to the aircraft that we had, in so much as you had an airspeed indicator, an altimeter, a compass, turn and bank, and climb and descent. And it was simply teaching you to scan round these and make the aircraft do what you wanted it to do. And the instructor sat on the outside and spoke to you and told you what he would like you to do and then watched how you did it. And, for example, like when we were at Kingston, Ontario, we had to have, in the period that we were there, 36 hours link trainer practice. And there's no doubt that it really was a very good idea for when you went night flying. But we didn't very often go into cloud, to tell you the truth, because once you were in cloud, the difficulty was getting out of it again. And there was no real radio aid and certainly no radar aid to get you out of clouds at that time. So it was useful for getting us in the right sense of concentrating on the instruments when you're night flying and you had no horizon. But what I was thinking about more than the link trainer itself, which was really very simple, when we went into torpedo training at Crail, RNAS Crail, that incident was called HMS Jackdaw, it just occurs to me. They had the normal link trainer there, but they also had what was called the torpedo attack teacher. And this was, in effect, a link trainer within a special building. And the bit, I don't know if you know what the Wall of Death looks like. Have you ever heard of it? Well, the Wall of Death just gives you a very good impression of what this building was like, with a link trainer in the middle and a circular wall around it. And on the circular wall, they projected films. And the films that we were looking at were films of a ship at sea. And you would get the aspect of when you were flying above it, when you were diving down, and when you were turning in on it. And the whole idea was to get you to do the diving in the right position onto the ship and make sure that while you were diving, you were able to set the torpedo sight. Because if you remember, we had to watch the ship and decide what speed it was doing and whether it was avoiding left or avoiding right and how that was going to affect us when we were dropping a torpedo. Would it be turning away from us or turning towards? And this sight that we had was simply a mechanical device on the left-hand side of the cockpit, just behind the throttles. And you had to set a little model ship to represent the direction that the ship was going, set the speed, and then there was a lever beside it which was avoiding away or avoiding towards. And you would get this all set while you were in the dive so that when you were pulling out of the dive and turning into the ship, it was all just about ready for you. And you might have to adjust a little bit on the direction of the ship once you were going in towards it. But this was without doubt the very first simulator that used an external bit of information for the pilot to look at and decide what he was going to do. And looking back on it, I think it was extremely well done. I don't know who thought it up and who worked out the mechanics of it, but it was a very clever device, bearing in mind the level of knowledge that we had in these matters of simulation, which was really very, very elementary. But the torpedo attack teacher was another thing that we had to do very regularly, and all of us in the squadron had to get a certain number of hours while we were doing the training at Crail. And of course, on a rainy day, there was a queue of people waiting to get into the torpedo attack teacher just to take advantage of the weather, but still keep in practice. But looking back on it, it really was a very good device and very cleverly done.
And did it bear a relation to when you actually did actual practice?
Oh, yes, it was. Obviously not exact, but it was close enough for us to be able to have a very clear picture when we started to do the attack. See, I don't know if I mentioned it when I was talking about training at Crail, but the thing that we were training to do was to get the maximum number of aircraft in on the target at the same time, so that the ship's anti-aircraft fire was spread as far as possible. And we trained with 12 aircraft at a time, divided into two flights of six, and we would try to manoeuvre ourselves into position where we were one on each bow of the ship, perhaps 5 miles ahead of it. And then we would all dive together, 12 aircraft diving at the one target. And it was very frightening, but we didn't ever actually have any mid-air collisions. But there was always the thought it could happen any time. And going down in the dive when you had all these aircraft around you, you really couldn't afford to take your eye off the target and see where other aircraft were. You just had to hope that at the end of it all, we'd all fly back from it. But the torpedo attack teacher, the simulator, was really extremely good. And I think it helped us quite a lot to be able to concentrate on doing what we had to do to get the torpedo sight set. And as I said, the sight was simply a mechanical connection from the pilot's cockpit through the bottom of the aircraft into the torpedo. And turning and setting the mechanical control in the cockpit actually turned the controls within the torpedo. So once it was dropped from the aircraft and it was running free, it had set on it how the torpedo rudders were going to be set to get it to run in the right direction. So once again, I think it was all very cleverly done, but it wasn't used often enough to tell the truth. We didn't do as many torpedo attacks on ships as would have been really successful if we had all got into the practice. See, when we were, for example, out in Korea, when you were going out three times a day dive bombing, within a very short time, you became very accurate. And if we'd been doing the same amount of actual runner torpedo dropping against ships, I think we would have become just as skillful and hit more targets than we did. Because there's no doubt that we used to miss a lot with the torpedoes. Now, I don't know if that was a matter of the ship being skillful or us being clumsy.
It struck me when you were describing it that it's quite a difficult thing to get right, though.
Oh, yes. It is, absolutely. And I think you needed a lot more practice doing it, and doing it under stress, to be sure that when you were attacking a ship that you were still doing it as near to correctly as you could. But again, it was all primitive stuff, as I say. And there was an awful lot of guesswork in the speed of the ship and its course, because you had to set this little ship, which was, as far as we were concerned, we're trying to set this little ship on the site to run parallel to what the ship was doing down there. Well, again, you could be 5 degrees out, you could be even 10 degrees out quite easily. And as to whether it was going to avoid by turning away from you or towards you, at the end of the day, that was a guess, and you could be 180 degrees wrong quite easily.
One other thing that I think we should put on the record is about the aircraft that's in the Fleet Air Arm Museum. Because I believe it's one of the aircraft that you flew while you were in Korea.
Yes, I did. It actually had the name of Lieutenant McKeown on it, and it was flown in Korea by Lieutenant McKeown, but it came back to this country, and I flew it at Lossiemouth in October 1953. I can't find it now. Here it is. I knew it was in here somewhere. VR930 was the airframe number, and I flew it September the 15th, September the 18th, and another couple of times when it was up at Lossiemouth as part of the establishment of the training squadron. Yeah, there's two more there in August. So it was nice to see it again. And I think the next time I go down to Yeovil, to the museum, I'll take my logbook with me and persuade the curator to allow me to have my photograph taken with it 50 years later. That'd be nice.
So to take up the narrative, you'd arrived back from Korea.
Yes, well, of course we had some leave. And then I was appointed to a squadron at RNAS Brodie. That's in South Wales. And from Brodie, we were sent to one of the satellite airfields at a place called St. David's. And it was really quite a primitive airfield. And a lot of the people who were doing the conversion course actually lived in the wardroom at Brodie and came over by transport every day. But I had my wife there with me, and we lived in digs down in St. David's village. And then I just walked up to the airfield to work. But we were there to do jet conversion training. And the jet conversion was done on Meteor 7s. And of course, I hadn't flown twin-engined aircraft before, and I hadn't flown jets before, so it was quite a thrill getting off on this machine. And I thoroughly enjoyed the jet conversion training. It was all RAF pilots, again, who were doing the conversion training. And one of the things that I do remember about the Meteor 7 was, after being flying around at 30,000 feet for three-quarters of an hour or an hour, the cold had really soaked into the aircraft, and the metal was minus 30 or something like that. And the outside of the aircraft was really cold, but the cockpit was fine. The heating in the cockpit kept things very comfortable. And then you come down fairly fast to land, and you come whistling into the circuit, and coming round in the final approach to land, quite suddenly, the whole of the inside of the cockpit would mist over, because it was still cold on the outside and steaming hot on the inside. And that was quite the wrong time not to be able to see where you were going. So the first time that happened to me, I really did get, shall we say, a surprise. So I just opened up, went round again, and fiddled about till I could find out how to do it. And then one of the instructors said, well, I usually carry a rag with some glycol in it. So when that happens, I just give the windscreen a quick wipe, and it lets you get down to land without having all this bother of going round again and trying to get rid of the misting on the inside. But the other thing, of course, which was interesting was, I don't know if you remember, but on the Meteor, the engines are set quite well out in the wings, perhaps 10 or 12 feet away from the fuselage, so that if you're in a position where one engine stops, the other engine is still pushing, but it's got a lot of leverage with this 12-foot difference between the fuselage and the actual power from the engine. So the normal natural reaction for the aircraft is to turn away from the engine with power. So you've got to be able to react very quickly if you're taking off at full power and one engine fails, because you really have to get maximum rudder on to hold the aircraft straight. And at that time, we in a single engine aircraft had never experienced this. So when the instructor did it to you for the first time, it was a fantastic surprise how much strength you needed to hold the aircraft straight. And as I say, that was particularly important at takeoff, but obviously we did our practices at 5,000 feet or whatever it was, just to feel what it was like. And it meant that when you were settling yourself into the aircraft and you were trying all the flying controls to make sure they were all free and easy, when you were trying the rudders, you had to be absolutely certain that you could push the rudder to the maximum in either direction and hold it there with a lot of pressure against your foot. So you couldn't have it at the maximum stretch of your legs. You had to have it where you could still really put pressure on it. And I wasn't used to sitting in the aircraft like that. But you had to learn to do it really quite quickly.